Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in association with the NorCal Peace Corps Association. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening's presentation. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Today, a growing number of failed and failing states are unable to carry out the basic responsibilities that have long been considered the cornerstones of state sovereignty. In fact, a recent Brookings Institution report describes nearly 60 such countries, more than a quarter of all United Nations members, that are unable to meet the basic requirements of statehood. What, or rather who, is keeping these states from falling into the abyss of full state failure? Increasingly, the thin line that separates weak states from failed states is being manned by a hodgepodge of international charities, aid agencies, global corporations, philanthropists, foreign advisors, and corporate managers. These groups, supported by bilateral aid flows, the lucre of transnational organizations or their own private funds, are increasingly assuming basic state responsibilities by providing a host of services, including health care, education, and even security. 5 decades after the end of the colonial era, they are fast becoming the new colonialists of the 21st century. Michael Cohen is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where he co-helms the Privatization of Foreign Policy Initiative, which examines the growing influence and impact of non-state actors in U.S. foreign policy. He is also the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. Previously, Michael served in the U.S. Department of State as chief speechwriter for U.S. Representative to the United Nations Bill Richardson and Undersecretary of State Stuart Eisenstadt. He has worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Foreign Policy magazine and as chief speechwriter for Senator Chris Dodd, the Democrat from Connecticut. He was a senior vice president at the strategic communications firm of Robinson, Lehrer, and Montgomery and has worked on political campaigns both in the U.S. and overseas. Michael serves on the board of the National Security Network and has taught at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. So now let's welcome Michael Cohen to our podium.
Thank you, Karen, for that very nice introduction. Karen referenced my book, Live from the Campaign Trail, which actually includes 2 speeches that were delivered at the Commonwealth Club, one in 1932 by Franklin Roosevelt, and the other by, of all people, Dan Quayle, 1992, the infamous Murphy Brown speech. So it's an honor to be asked to speak at this august locale. And I will do everything in my power to emulate the former speaker rather than the latter today. Back in 2008, a couple of colleagues of mine at New America, Parag Khanna and Maria Figueroa Kupchu, we were having drinks one night, and we thought it would be interesting to write something about this growing phenomenon, a propensity of non-state actors like NGOs, philanthropists, private companies, and others to take over key responsibilities of state actors. And we wondered what that said about the responsibilities, indeed the very sovereignty of not just failed states, but countries on the brink of state failure, what we called flailing states. We weren't sure what the solution was, thought it would make for an interesting phenomenon, and one that I think is certainly familiar to those people who worked in the aid industry. And then we thought, wouldn't it be provocative to call the piece the New Colonialists, as if to suggest this somehow represented a new, more altruistic form of state takeover by Western countries and actors. This was our mistake, because when the piece came out, a lot of folks said and wrote This article makes some important points. It highlights an interesting phenomenon, what have you. But colonialists, how pejorative. How dare you compare NGOs to the rapacious imperialists of the 19th century, and so on. And in fairness, the complaints had merit. But to me, it seemed a semantic distraction from the larger point about the erosion of state sovereignty and the growing influence, sometimes unaccountable influence, of non-state actors. So what I'm going to do tonight is offer some thoughts from that article that we wrote, with three caveats, if I may. One, I would ask audience members to take the new colonialists title with a grain of salt. It is as much a rhetorical device as it is a literal description of the actors we describe, or I describe. Second, I want to keep in mind, because this is it often gets misunderstood, this argument is not an attack on foreign aid or certainly on its practitioners, a la William Easterly or Dambisa Moyo. It's more an effort to get to the heart of a growing and, I would argue, defining feature of international affairs in the 21st century. And third, the new colonialists, as Karen suggested, are not just NGOs. They are a whole set of private actors, from philanthropists and private companies to private individuals, and I'll get to that in more detail. And finally, before I start, I should say on a personal note that the original this article was written for Foreign Policy magazine in 2008, and the original version of the article I always thought was much better than the version that actually got published in the magazine. For those of you who experience publishing long journal articles, this is not an unusual experience. I don't want to blame Foreign Policy if anyone from the magazine is listening right now. But it was always sort of a hope of mine to have some outlet for the actual longer and sort of more in-depth article that we had written. So I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak here tonight. I want to start by paraphrasing the legendary Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart and his famous remark about obscenity. Generally, you know a failed state when you see one. They are states that essentially exist in name only. They are governments who are mired in corruption and endemic dysfunction. They're torn by ethnic strife, and they're dangerously incapable of carrying out the most basic responsibilities of statehood. For the unlucky millions who live in these politically unstable and socially destitute places, there's often no refuge from conflict, little basic food security, and scant hope for a better life. The globe is replete with tragic examples. Somalia, Congo, Chad come to mind. Chad's southern neighbor, Central African Republic, is so dysfunctional that it's been dubbed a phantom state because it owes, in part, its very survival to the largesse of aid workers and development consultants. But beyond these obvious cases, and these are often the ones that sort of get focused on these types of debates, is a broader class of countries teetering on the edge. Some are developing nations that are beginning to turn the corner. Yet many of these states are not necessarily failed, but failed or flailing was the expression I always like to use. They're actually descending deeper into foreign dependency. In fact, as Karen referenced in her opening remarks, a 2008 Brookings Institution report described nearly 60 countries, which actually is a third of all UN members, unable to meet the basic requirements of statehood. And I'm going to repeat a little bit of what Karen said in her introduction because it's part of the my speech. But what, or rather who, again, is keeping these states out of the abyss? And not long ago was the countries of the West, the United Nations, other transnational organizations have propped up failing governments. Today, however, the thin line that separates weak states and failed states is manned by a hodgepodge of international charities, aid agencies, global corporations, philanthropists, and foreign advisors. These groups supported by bilateral aid flows, the funding from transnational organizations, or even their own private funds, are increasingly taking on more and more basic state responsibilities and providing for the health, welfare, and safety of citizens in marginal states. They are fast becoming the proverbial new colonialists of the 21st century. Without their assistance and benevolence, many failing states or failing countries would collapse in anarchy or simply cease to exist. This armada of non-state actors has become an institutional and unmovable global force. They include international development groups like Oxfam, humanitarian NGOs such as Doctors Without Borders, faith-based organizations like Mercy Corps, mega-philanthropies like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and even multinational companies such as Coca-Cola and Merck. These actors have become a seamless element of global governance and service provision from Cambodia and Afghanistan to Georgia, Haiti, and entire swaths of sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, these actors are not extracting resources from poor nations to send back home like the actual colonialists of yore. Many of these actors are injecting sorely needed new ideas and essential services. Indeed, their rising prominence is bringing a powerful combination of grassroots activism, new entrepreneurial development thinking, and support for local civil society groups, which is essential to long-term development. With state aid budgets plateauing or even decreasing, and the barriers to entry falling even lower for these new actors, the efforts of the new colonialists show little signs of abating. If anything, I think they're going to be increasing in the years to come. In many weak states, the new colonialists are the glue holding society together. But on another level, they are tightening the chains of dependence. And as the new colonials continue to take on greater responsibilities or transfer them to the non-governmental sector, many governments are failing to develop the skills needed to run their own countries. The obvious question arises, have these actors gone too far in attempting to manage responsibilities that should be the preserve of governments? Or is there a more disturbing reality or a possibility? Perhaps the new colonialists are not going far enough. Dependency is certainly not a new phenomenon in the world's most destitute places. What has changed, however, is the scale of dependence and the growing shift from public to private responsibility. In 1970, 7 out of every $10 in the United States that went to the developing world came from official development assistance, ODA. Today, ODA makes up about 15% of resource flows, with 85% of money that goes to the United States into a developing world coming in the form of private capital flows, remittances, NGO contributions. And it's not just an American phenomenon. In 2006, total aid to the developing world from countries of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, amounted to $325 billion. Just a third of that came from governments. And more, it's the non-governmental sector that is picking up the slack. Spending by CARE, for example, jumped by 65% in the aughts, in the 1999-2007. Save the Children's budget has tripled since 98. Doctors Without Borders has doubled since 2001. The expenditures of Mercy Corps has nearly jumped 700% from 97 to 2006. And by one estimate, the nonprofit sector is responsible for between $58 and $68 billion in development funds. And even when wealthy nations pony up cash, it often bypasses foreign treasuries and goes into the hands of those providing day-to-day services. USAID, for example, has become a little more, I should say, U.S. Agency for National Development, has become a little more than a contract-giving, grant-making agency, with most of its operating budget going to for-profit consultancies, such as Chemonics International, its largest budgetary recipient. By some estimates, as much as 90% of the AID budget, the programming budget, goes to contractors and grantees. It's an organization that's basically been cratered over the past 15 to 20 years. Even more important than actual dollars is how the money is being spent and which actors are ultimately being empowered. When Chad, for example, discovered oil reserves in its impoverished nation, international oil companies, the World Bank, and prominent NGOs created a development scheme purposely designed to exclude the Chadian government as corrupt ministries. When a report several years ago detailing the aid situation in Afghanistan criticized the heavy reliance on private contractors and for-profit companies, aid groups defended themselves by noting the Afghan government simply lacked the capacity to competently distribute funds and implement aid mandates on their own, a phenomenon that our military is experiencing today. The influx of private dollars and know-how was also creating a stronger voice for non-governmental actors in setting development strategies and goals, and occasionally cutting out the middleman of state governments. In sub-Saharan Africa, about half of the nearly $17 billion spent on healthcare comes from private enterprises and charities. McKinsey views healthcare in Africa as a growing sector, for the private sector. And in South Africa, healthcare policy is being driven in many ways by the influence of outside donors, like the Gates Foundation and other national organizations. Instead, the scale of scope of the new colonialist intervention puts them in an unprecedented position to shape the future of the world's most economically challenged nations and supplant the one sacrosanct notion of state sovereignty. The new colonists are doing more than simply carrying out the mandates of wealthy benefactors or exploiting the consequences of state incapacity. Impatient and powerful, with the resources and the will to roll up their sleeves and work on the ground, they're taking charge of global challenges that both donor and recipient governments have either ignored or are simply incapable of responding to. And the international community dithers in dealing with global crises, such private efforts are increasingly coordinating among themselves to achieve a level of scale and sustainability that is greater than the sum of its parts. With every new global crisis, NGOs and private actors are learning to work with one another in a continuum that stretches from emergency relief and post-conflict reconstruction to economic development. The role and responsibilities of the new colonialist takes diverse and complex forms. Their impact can be seen in public health, in environmental initiatives, social development, stimulating entrepreneurship, military training, even democracy promotion. But I would argue that whatever the task, the result is often the same, the slow and steady erosion of state sovereignty and capacity. Afghanistan is going to be a prime example of the 21st century's mixture of private and public actors, with a national government that possesses only the most rudimentary sovereignty. Although Britain's Department of International Development, the DFID, channels 80% of its aid through Afghan ministries, the money is often swiftly handed to Oxfam for the usual actual construction of schools and hospitals. In fact, a significant percentage of all Afghan services and almost all public health services are delivered by NGOs, who receive almost as much aid money in total as Afghan ministries do, and probably for the better, considering the performance of Afghan ministries. This model for education was actually applied also, this model for health was also applied to the education sector. The private sector is also involved in nation's development. When Coca-Cola opened its first bottling plant in Kabul, it was created not only jobs, but also the country's largest water filtration plant. Taken together, it is the interplay of foreign financing, on-the-ground support, and the search for a pipeline to the global marketplace that makes the new colonialists an indispensable part of the weak state's mix. Georgia is another example, maybe a surprising one, of a state deeply reliant on financing and management from the outside. Again, one that would not traditionally come to mind. To ensure safe passage of oil through the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, the world's second longest, in 2005, the U.S. and other European governments helped to rebuild Georgia's government ministries from the ground up by using the consultancy Booz Allen Hamilton. The recruited staff from the Georgian diaspora were trained bureaucrats and conflated American strategic priorities with Georgian ministries on everything from budget planning to implementation. These hybrid technocrat consultants are part of the country's day-to-day decision-making on parliamentary legislation, political reform, intelligence sharing, and pipeline protection. Young Georgians, particularly those with a Western education, often prefer to work for the better-paying new colonialists rather than their own government, which seems to be in a perpetual state of dependence. And this dynamic reveals an increasingly common and perverse situation in flailing states. Western consultancies play a significant role in establishing and shaping major government functions and then write the complex grant applications that their home governments receive on behalf of their hosts, actually extending their own positions of prominence. I remember meeting a young woman who actually went to Georgia, and she wrote or helped the Georgian government write their application for Millennium Challenge Corporation grant money. She was an American doing this on behalf of the Georgian government, hired by a consultancy to do this. The danger is a vicious cycle of dependency among the new colonialists themselves as they vie for the contracts that ultimately keep them in business. In few places are the efforts of these new actors more significant than public health. Take Cambodia, for example, which boasts a somewhat thriving international garment trade and plays host to millions of tourists each year, although I'm sure that number has gone down in recent months because of the economic downturn. Yet the public health care system in Cambodia is in such disrepair the government was forced to turn to NGOs such as HealthNet and others to provide care for its citizens. More than two-thirds of Cambodia's healthcare spending comes from international donors such as Japan and China, and the non-governmental sector has emerged as such a reliable source of healthcare solutions, it's difficult to imagine the public sector taking over responsibility anytime soon. The role of NGOs and private agencies in improving Cambodia's healthcare system is having a ripple effect. Recently, the British magazine Lancet, which is a prominent public health magazine, has urged other weak states to adopt the Cambodian model, reflecting a seismic shift in development approaches. In Botswana not long ago, the country's president warned his nation was, quote, threatened with extinction because of some of the highest HIV and AIDS rates in the world. While a relative oasis of prosperity and stability in sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana still came to rely very deeply on the intervention of the Gates Foundation and the pharmaceutical giant Merck, as well as the United Nations, in developing a coordinated and comprehensive campaign to fight the disease, with positive results that did, in fact, save lives. And the Gates Foundation is one of the highest-profile examples of how private actors are changing the development world, or developing world. Such a significant player in the global health field that its efforts, once lauded, are starting to draw criticism from public health experts who see the charity rivaling the World Health Organization as a global agenda setter of public health priorities. The foundation's efforts in malaria research alone, which had largely been abandoned by drug companies, jumped from less than $100 million in the late 90s to more than $1 billion spent since 2000. And if you talk to people in the public health sector, I mean, they'll tell you this, that the Gates Foundation is as influential and as important an actor on public health as the WHO is, in some ways more. And even for researchers doing work in these areas, you have to keep in mind the priorities of the Gates Foundation when actually making decisions on funding. And you've seen a lot of this in malaria research in particular, in which their views actually drove a lot of the research protocols that came about in the last few years on malaria research. So the influence is quite significant. And, of course, Gates Foundation, for all the great work it does, is a relatively unaccountable organization that is accountable really pretty much to its donors, who are few and far between. Then, of course, you have the corporate sector. You have drug companies like Merck, Pfizer, Novartis that are regularly credited with taking initiative to wipe out global disease. Companies like General Electric fund $20 million worth of health programs in Ghana, for example. In South Africa, it's now the norm for Western mining companies to provide not only AIDS treatment, but testing for their workers. And when you consider the retrograde views of the South African government in recent years on HIV/AIDS, this is almost certainly a good thing. The people served by these programs are likely far better off than if such duties had fallen to their national leaders. And as globalization trumps sovereignty as an organizing principle for power, more and more citizens will expect their livelihoods and welfare to come from powerful non-state actors than their failed governments. And my favorite example of sort of declining influence of state sovereignty and the emergence of this sort of empowered non-state class is Bangladesh, which not long ago was ranked by Goldman Sachs as an up-and-coming emerging market. It's, in fact, the world's 31st largest economy. But just don't thank the nation's leaders for this economic turnaround. In many respects, it's the result of homegrown NGOs and a thriving civil society supported by national aid donors. As one observer noted in 2002, in some villages you can send your child to an NGO school, have a vasectomy arranged by an NGO health worker, sell your milk to an NGO dairy, and talk on an NGO phone. There's usually a choice of several NGO banks. There's even NGO entertainment. With a government constantly ranked among the most corrupt in the world, and certainly one of the least capable, it's small wonder that it is increasingly becoming an abstraction to its own citizens. Aided and abetted by foreign donors, the nation's largest NGO development organization, BRAC, is one of the biggest in the world, employing more than 97,000 people. It reaches 110 million people, has created more than 6 million jobs, has opened 32,000 primary schools, and is now becoming increasingly self-reliant, decreasing its dependence on donor funding to just under 30%. And it's even expanding into failing states like Afghanistan and Sudan, becoming in its own right a new colonialist. The rising influence of these actors thus confronts weak states with a new reality and a moral hazard. The choice is not whether or not to work with them, but how to work with them most instructively. At present, the best local talent prefers to work with the new colonialists, not only because the salaries are better and the work has more impact, but because there's no comparable opportunity in the civil service or private sector. Once engaged with these transnational organizations, local talent is often drawn to join the ranks of the global civil society, rather than stay in their home country to do the difficult work of creating change. New colonialists depend on this talent to ensure legitimacy and local expertise that will ensure their continued relevance. So between the old and new colonialism, some things do appear to have remained the same. Whether we states are dependent on aid agencies, NGOs, or corporations, or a combination of all three, the question remains, how can their authority and responsibility become better aligned? There is, as of now, no single global clearinghouse that coordinates or even tracks how these new actors behave around the world. If the new colonialists run the show in failing states, there's little reason to believe the vicious cycle of mutual dependence will ever be broken. And if that's the case, how and when can full sovereignty and legitimate government capacity ever arise? Indeed, what if the new colonial crutch actually enables corrupt governments to keep avoiding their responsibilities to their citizens and, say, focus on building armies or amassing fortunes rather than schools and hospitals? Wasn't the end of the Cold War meant to bring greater sovereignty, independence, and more open markets? Greater dependence on outsiders was not part of the deal. And what happens when aid groups shut off the spigot or move on to other challenges, or face economic downturns, as we've seen in recent years? Having said all that, the reality is that there's no turning back the clock or curtailing the global role of non-state actors. It's not merely a trend. It is a significant manifestation of globalization itself. So in many respects, the new colonialism is neither good nor bad. People always ask me that question, is this a good or a bad thing? And I always say it's not a good or bad thing, it's a thing. And it's certainly here to stay. The question is not a question almost it's like someone asking you, is globalization good or bad? And I would sort of say, well, some people might think it's good, some people think it's bad, but that isn't really the question. The question is, how do you deal with this new reality, because that's the world that we're living in today. In fact, I think it's time to be much more honest about the kind of global governance the world is heading toward. Now, some people like Dambisa Moyo, author of the, I would argue, somewhat misguided and even frightful Dead Aid, believe that governments and their NGO allies should get out of the development business altogether. The market will solve these problems. But this ignores the challenge of good governance, which does not sprout as quickly as markets do, not to mention the fact that new investment often avoids failing states. What's more, there's a disturbing reality that many observers don't want to countenance, that the dependence of weak states is not a temporary situation to be one day remedied. It is indeed a central reality of 21st century politics. Will a country like Afghanistan, for example, and this is a very pressing issue today, always be dependent on foreign assistance in perpetuity? It's quite possible. And without the new colonialists, will today's marginal states become tomorrow's Chad or Congo or Somalia or other failed state? Some have suggested it's time to restore the centrality of the UN to arbitrate interventions, and have even broached the idea of creating neo-trusteeships of failed states. I was actually surprised to read that, there have been in the last 4 or 5 years, at least 5 foreign affairs articles that have sort of broached this notion of creating trusteeships for the world's failed states. But I would argue globalization resists the centralization of power and its sapped influence in the UN and other transnational organizations. Simply put, the UN is no longer up to the task, and it lacks the support of member states to take on such ambitious and expensive goals. And of course, the colonialism and trusteeship of the past wasn't all that either. It's not as though returning to that particular past is a good idea for anybody. And then there are the dogmatic advocates of the new colonialism itself, who impatiently lament government inefficiency, yet of course suffer from their own strains of wasteful overlap, cronyism, and unaccountability. What Afghan President Hamid Karzai has derided as the scourge of NGOism. For better or worse, the future of global governance is all of the above at the same time. There's no roadmap and there's no one-size-fits-all strategy. There will be not one clear winner in the free-for-all of the new colonialism. Rather, it's a supermarket of ideas and solutions in which legitimacy accrues to those who act and those who are welcome back. The governing principle of this market won't necessarily be democracy, and it won't be current notions of authority which require the sanction of UN resolutions. Rather, the fundamental challenge of this messy new landscape will be to establish some sort of system of mutual accountability among donors, activists, relief organizations, failed state governments, failing state governments, multinational corporations, and all other interested groups. Indeed, the current push for greater NGO accountability, which there's quite a bit of literature about, is often donor-driven. And as some have noted, accountability in practice is emphasized upward, and external accountability to donors, while downward and internal mechanisms remain comparatively underdeveloped. In fact, stricter external accountability mechanisms may end up stifling the sort of experimentation and innovation that is needed on the ground in failed states. And not surprisingly, many NGOs and other groups look suspiciously upon these mechanisms. And of course, the issue isn't just about NGO accountability. What about philanthropic foundations like the Gates Foundation, or private companies, or other private actors? This gets to another issue, which is, in some ways, what one NGO representative said to me was the holy grail of foreign assistance: integration, and integrating various efforts of assistance actors. I'm generally loath to quote William Easterly because I find much of what he writes quite interesting. I disagree with other parts. But there's this one line, paragraph in his book I wanted to read because I thought it was actually quite, makes his point quite well. He says, talking about foreign aid in Bolivia, he says, operating in the Bolivian mountains are the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, USAID, U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the U.K. Department for National Development, just about every rich country's aid agency, multiple NGOs, and Bono. And often sometimes at the same time. And so the question, having looked at this issue, even in the U.S. government, there's a lack of aid integration, even among U.S. governmental agencies, where you have state doing one thing and DOD doing something else and USAID doing something else, and a lack of integration along those actors. Imagine hard enough to get the U.S. government on the same page. Imagine having to integrate all these different private and public actors, which is one of the reasons why it's so hard. But I think, in a sense, it is actually essential to how we sort of deal with this new global reality. Just as an example of sort of how this integration materializes, in sub-Saharan Africa, we've seen some of these problems with a philanthropic focus on fighting disease, such as malaria and HIV, which is often run counter to state desires for the development of health infrastructure. Indeed, precious little in global health spending goes to infrastructure and health networks, and far too much to disease. And that really is a donor-driven phenomenon, not a recipient-driven phenomenon. Bill Clinton makes a very wise point that, you know, the solution to solving the HIV crisis actually exists. We have the actual knowledge of how to ameliorate this crisis. We don't have the infrastructure to get the drugs and to get these medical solutions to people who need them. And so the infrastructure issue is a huge issue. But so much of what drives healthcare, public healthcare, depending on a global scale, is disease-driven. But in the end, I think there's a larger conclusion to be drawn from what I've talked about here and from this situation. It's that the state's monopoly on power, which we've all become used to for several hundred years, is slowly but irrevocably eroding away. No longer are security, public services, even political reform, the exclusive domain of states, even in states that are not generally considered to be failing or flailing. A whole host of new non-state actors are stepping into the fray, taking on more and more roles and changing the way we think about the very concept of sovereignty and the responsibility of the nation state. And while states remain important actors, and they will remain important actors, they're not the only actors anymore, a fact which reaches beyond just failed states and may come to define the world of the future. Indeed, if there is one overarching takeaway, I hope you take from what I said today, that the rise of these new actors and the decline of states as powerful forces of change, that we're moving to a future in which non-state actors and not states may hold sway. In other words, the era of the nation state may one day soon be replaced by the era of the non-state actor. Thank you very much.
A member of the club's International Relations member-led forum. While those with questions line up behind this microphone, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to The New Colonialists, how NGOs, non-governmental organizations, non-state actors, and private citizens are transforming state sovereignty, with Michael Cohen, Senior Research Fellow with the New America Foundation. Let me ask the first question while I'm here. How do you see microenterprise programs as helping or colonializing these countries?
Well, I think there has been a notion in recent years that microenterprise is somehow a panacea for what ails failing states, and I don't actually, I think it's probably a little overstated, but I think it's part of the solution, part of the problem, because it helps develop entrepreneurship, it helps develop new industries, but a focus on it tends to undermine the larger goal of increasing state capacity, and so that in a sense is a lot of what we're talking about here is that state governments are unable to provide the very public services that you and I take for granted in this country for their citizens. However, I think that kind of approach is where more and more aid money I think is going. It's probably a good thing for people on the ground, but I do worry a little bit about how that effect will have on developing that kind of state capacity.
I know this takes some generalizing. How do you see the proportion between local population members and foreigners participating as the so-called new colonialists in various countries?
You know, if I had my druthers, I would personally, I'd like to see a lot more of the assistance money, especially from the United States, go toward local civil society groups. I think that's really the key to developing, not just as a development goal, and not just as a means of actually improving development, but I think also of actually building capacity over the long run. I mean, I looked at this issue actually from a democracy promotion perspective, and one of the things that's sort of interesting is that, especially in really fairly corrupt or sort of failed states, providing assistance for democracy promotion actually ends up causing more problems than it solves. In a sense, developing local civil society and strengthening civil society actually has a much more positive impact, I think, on the long-term development of democracy, the long-term development of institutions that strengthen democracy. So I think, you know, Paul Collier makes this argument, and I think he's absolutely right, that technical assistance is what a lot of, really some of the worst states need. They don't need more money. More money is actually a lot of what their problem has become. They've ended up hoarding foreign assistance and not using it for what it needs to be used for. And I think one way to get to solve some of the problems that I'm sort of trying to get to in this argument is the more you can develop civil society, the better it's going to be for a lot of these countries. I think that's where a lot of the money should be going toward.
David Lair with Mercy Corps. Thank you for your comments. Important, though, to keep, I think, a few things in mind. First of all, Mercy Corps is not a faith-based organization, nor is it very large, having grown 700%. I think that's pretty correct. We're about a $300 million organization. I think Oxfam, $1.2 billion,
sure.
Maybe CARE and Save the Children, $700 or $800 million. So the actual amount of resources we have, while you're right, there's not that much accountability, I think is relatively small. And I think that the better organizations are really about trying to build civil society capacity. And at least in the Mercy Corps case, we've worked in 106 or 109 countries, and today we're only in 38. So you do have a sense of capacity building and leaving when that capacity has been, when we've done what we feel we can do. And then secondly, you're working in places like Somalia where piracy becomes the only means of employment. And so if somebody doesn't try to change that dynamic, then, I mean, you can call us the new colonialists, but I think if somebody doesn't try to change that dynamic and create hope and create alternative jobs and create healthy people, it's not clear to me that any of these failed states are ever going to really recover. So
I completely agree with that.
I guess I don't really have a question, but I just think it's important that these organizations are big, but we're not that big.
Listen, I completely agree with that last point you made. And I think that one of the things that's happened in recent years you've seen is there's been this sort of this movement of saying, well, foreign aid doesn't work, and that these foreign aid programs create more problems than they solve. I think that argument is wildly overstated, and I think it's overstated by people who have, frankly, other agendas. And so I think that the work of these organizations is incredibly important. And I think what the issue is that we are moving more and more to reality in which they have a huge impact on the sort of governance of these failed states and failing states. And it's not just NGOs, by the way, of course. I mean, that's an important too. I mean, you're absolutely right. The numbers are even much bigger. Look at the foundations, much lower. You look at transnational organizations, which have accountability mechanisms, but also not as strong as they should be. I think that the key is how do you create better accountability systems? And you know this, having worked in the NGO community, this has been a huge debate in recent years, how do you improve NGO accountability? And I think my sense of a little bit is it's a little too much donor-driven, a little less recipient-driven, and that's where I think some of the discussion maybe needs to move toward. But I agree with your point, and I would hate for you or anyone else to come across me as thinking that I'm bashing Mercy Corps or any other NGO group. I don't. I actually think they do important yeoman's work that makes an enormous difference for millions of people around the world.
Well, I guess you could say I'm a retiree from a very active organization, the Asia Foundation, which specialized in many countries in helping develop civil society organizations. You mentioned the new colonialism as if there had been a period of state sovereignty or of peace and progress in some of these countries which had formerly been colonies. Unfortunately, I think in the process of decolonization, what often happened would be a founding father would be a popular leader in bringing the helping the country, a country, if it's if it could be considered as such, to be decolonized. But unfortunately, as you know, power corrupts. And many persons who originally were considered great leaders, great founders of their country, eventually felt themselves indispensable. And there was a situation where the countries were colonized by their leaders, I guess you could say.
Absolutely.
So I agree with you. The question of how do the people of a country, many of these, which had never been nation states before, were artificial creations of the previous colonial powers. It seems to be it's a problem which cannot be easily solved.
Well, I think this, I mean, just for what it's worth, I mean, I think this issue of state, of eroding state sovereignty is not one that just applies to the developing world. I mean, I think I sort of raise this issue because of the level of engagement, if you will, from these actors. But, I mean, you see this in developing countries as well, or developed countries as well, eroding state sovereignty, the limited effectiveness of military power, the limited effectiveness of state power that you once have seen, countries that are hostage to international capital flows, countries that are buffeted by new technology, information technology in particular. So I think it's not just a question of developing countries, it's a question of countries all around the world, including the United States. I think you've seen, actually, to some extent, I would argue in Iraq and Afghanistan, prime examples of the limitations of American power in ways that maybe some Americans find uncomfortable. I don't, but some Americans do. And I think that, you know, what I think is interesting about what I call the new colonialists is the extent to which they are having such an enormous impact that I think is an understated, underappreciated phenomenon of global affairs in the 21st century.
What do you think about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? It kind of strikes me as a sort of monopoly on certain parts of, I guess, aid. I mean, the fact that two people can head up an entire, like, division on and control, like, malaria research. I mean, it's really good because they can dump a bunch of money into finding and researching and curing diseases. So is there anything bad about that, like, that they play such a huge role in something that big, or, like,
I mean, the Gates Foundation does a lot of really amazing work, both in the United States and overseas. What's interesting is that one thing about the Gates Foundation I think is fascinating is they're not really an accountable organization. I mean, they have this enormous impact on public health decision-making, on decision-making that NGOs make on global health, and they don't really have a great deal of accountability for what they're doing. Secondly, I think what's interesting, what's happened in recent years, and I mentioned the malaria example, there was a big to-do a couple of years ago about this, where the WHO complained bitterly that the money that the Gates Foundation was putting toward malaria research was moving that research in a direction they thought was the wrong direction to be going from a medical research standpoint. And this created a lot of dissension. And if you talk to people in the global health world, since so many of them rely on money from the Gates Foundation, I mean, virtually all of them, I would even say, they are loath to criticize the Gates Foundation or loath to criticize decision-making of the Gates Foundation. I don't think Gates Foundation is a bad organization. I think the work that the Gates have done is incredible, and I give a lot of credit to both of them for making philanthropic efforts their life serve work. But there is an issue to consider here when it comes to questions of accountability that I think deserves to be to be debated.
Thank you.
Sure.
To follow up on that, I listened to Meet the Press on Sunday, and they had Bill and Melinda Gates on there. I think it was, I don't know if any of the rest of you saw it, but I thought it was on that program or another one I saw where they do have an assessment team to determine. This one guy who's the head of it spoke about how they do plan on assessing their work in these other countries. Have you heard about that?
And all NGO groups have assessment teams as well. I mean, in fact, one of the problems, I'm sure, and you can probably relate to this, some people in the NGO community say there's too much assessment that's asked to be done, particularly by actually state governments that give aid to these groups. They actually I mean, if I'd like to see, frankly, it's funny in some ways, you almost want to see, there's a yin and the yang here. You do want to see more accountability. At the same time, you also want the flexibility of these groups to operate. I'm sure Gates Foundation does plenty of assessments of their work. But who's assessing their work? I think it's generally the Gates Foundation doing a lot of their own assessment. I'm not sure how, I mean, I think one thing you do need a lot more of is independent aid evaluation. I think that's a crucial reform that we could see more of, as opposed to aid organizations doing their own assessments. I mean, you could create, obviously the UN is one body for it, but you have all kinds of independent groups that do these types of certifications in other areas. I'm not sure what you have it in American public health. You have independent groups that do certification. You could create international groups to do that type of certification. It's not I don't think it'd be that hard of a thing to set up.
Is it in Sudan that they're developing the Chinese? Are developing, is it a dam or a train, a railroad? Does anybody remember?
The Chinese actually, this actually is maybe more of a better example of new colonialism than the one I even cited. I mean, the Chinese are playing an enormous role in investment in sub-Saharan Africa. And in many ways, they're perpetuating many of the problems that you actually were referring to of using focusing more on their own economic interests than on sort of larger humanitarian interests. And one of the things, and I come back to this because I really dislike the argument that was made in this book, but Dambisa Moyo in her book Dead Age, she actually uses the example of Chinese investment as the key to Africa, sub-Saharan Africa's problems. They need more investment from China. We'll talk about unaccountable amounts of money. Talk about money that goes to generally corrupt and inefficient state governments that is used to perpetuate some of the things that have created this phenomenon of new colonialists. Chinese investment is a way to do it. One of the problems I think that's happened is that the Chinese have sort of, because it's almost a mercantilist system that they've adopted for of sub-Saharan Africa, and it's one that has actually been quite effective for them, in part because I think the U.S. has not been prominent enough when it comes to doing development work. And now I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second and say one of the problems is that I think it's a larger issue from the U.S. perspective is that we don't put enough resources and devote enough energy to development assistance. We have an aid organization, USAID, that is basically anyone who's worked with AID in this room who knows AID now, it's an ineffectual organization that basically relies on giving money to grant to contractors and grantees. We need a much stronger development organization in this country. We don't really have one. We also need to get out of the mindset that every foreign policy problem is conflated around the war on terrorism and is solved by sending military troops into harm's way. That would be a really good solution, frankly, for all the development challenges in Afghanistan, and they are many. I don't want to underplay that. There are development challenges in lots of places that haven't previously hosted international terrorists, and they also need American largesse, and not just because it's the right thing to do from an altruistic standpoint, it's also the right thing to do in furthering U.S. interests. And to go back to go full circle and answer this question, when you see China increasing its influence in places in sub-Saharan Africa and undermining democratic rule, undermining democratic governance by basically imposing a non-democratic model of governance, which is what they're doing, you see U.S. influence waning, and that's a bad thing. And I think to make this as topical as possible, this debate tomorrow. I mean, we're having this debate tomorrow about Afghanistan. The president's giving a speech saying 30,000 more troops. To me, that isn't the issue. I mean, the threat from Afghanistan is minimal. The threat that, from an international standpoint, that you're seeing from, first of all, the increase in this sort of Chinese model of development, lack of attention from the U.S. and other Western states to failing countries, that's a real serious problem that needs more attention, and needs more attention than Afghanistan, frankly. By the way, is 36 years old, who's younger than me, which I find both troubling and deflating at the same time, on a personal basis and a professional basis. He's 36 years old. He has no management experience, no contract management experience, which is really what you need to have if you actually run AID these days. And the fact is that individual was the last agency head appointed or selected by the Obama administration in the entire federal government. Last one, and they had to do it because the acting administrator's term was going to run out in a few days. It just, to me, is indicative of, unfortunately, this administration, which I'm generally supportive of, complete lack of attention to development and democracy issues. And I think, I remember during the campaign, President Obama said, that he wanted to change the mindset that got us. He didn't want to end the war in Iraq. He wanted to change the mindset that got us into Iraq in the first place. Well, sending more troops to Afghanistan, not putting more money in development and democracy promotion is a surefire way not to change the mindset that got us into Iraq in the first place.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has spoken consistently about the role of soft power. But it's not really, what do you think he means by that? And since he's a holdover from the previous administration, does this mean that he really has no power in this one? I was very encouraged by hearing him talk about this in the previous administration and have been disappointed to see how that has played out so far in this administration.
Okay, so when you hear Secretary of Defense Gates or other advocates of, say, counterinsurgency talk about the need to increase soft power or, say, the need to improve civilian agencies, you have to look closely at what they're saying. What they're really talking about is increasing civilian capacity to support national security operations. Okay, so what I'd love to see is Bob Gates say we need more money for development and building up civilian agencies that can work in non-kinetic environments, which means not places called Afghanistan, Pakistan, or Iraq. He hasn't been saying that. What he's saying is he wants more money to support these efforts. And if you look at where so much of development money and the U.S. government goes to, it goes to Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's where a lot of it is going towards, and that's only going to continue. He said that. Pakistan's an important place. I don't want to undermine that. It's a very important place. But there's lots of important places in the world that need American development assistance. And, you know, the thing is the amount of money we're talking about is not a huge amount of money. A small amount of money makes a very big difference in some of these places. When you think about a defense budget that is ballooning to over $600 billion a year versus development budget that, top of my head, I think it's about $20 or $30 billion. I may be wrong about that. Don't quote me. Sorry. But it's very much smaller. That's part of the problem, is there just a lack of interest in development money, but also in resources for development agencies, in resources for State Department, resources for basically non-military institutions of the federal government. If you talk to anybody who works in institutions, in State Department and AID, and they will tell you the crisis of morale, crisis of lack of resources, these are problems that the Defense Department does not have at all.
Well, in the foreign aid thing, wasn't it in the 90s that 90% of all foreign aid went to Egypt and Israel? Are we now switching to Iraq and Afghanistan?
That's actually bilateral treaty, that we are treaty-bound assistance, but development assistance has gone down. And actually, I hate to say this, as somebody who worked in the Clinton administration, a lot of the reason why we're in the situation we're in with AID is because of the Clinton administration, which allowed Republican Congress to incorporate AID into the State Department, which pretty much really, really harmed the organization significantly. Because nobody in the federal government and no one in Congress really truly cares about these agencies. They don't see it as crucial to American power. They don't see it crucial to American foreign policy. And there's a few people you might find on Capitol Hill who care and who think it's important, but more often than not, you'll find people who will say, why should I put more money into foreign rat holes around the world or put more money into striped pant diplomats at State Department? That's the reality.
It seems that a lot of the problems you're talking about relate to a mismatch in timing expectations, that development of infrastructure, development of civil society, if you will, is something that generally takes a long period of time. It's an evolution, and yet most of the solutions, particularly a lot of the newer innovations, if you will, in providing assistance, don't necessarily smack of a long-term commitment. It's sort of like, let's have a short-term answer and set something in motion and everything will be fine. Do you see anything that begins to address this?
I do, and in fact, this is actually a big sort of bugaboo that I have. I mean, it's hard for me to point to many foreign policy successes of the Bush administration. But I can count one, which is the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which I think is actually one of the best innovations in foreign assistance that we've come up with, which basically is to condition aid to countries based on changes and improvements in governance, improvements in ending this corruption, and it actually works with countries to develop aid development programs, development strategies, and works also with local civil society. It's a great way, I think, to dole out assistance. And if I had my way, I would make all U.S. assistance go through Millennium Challenge Corporation, aside from humanitarian and public health and disaster assistance. It's not going to happen, but that's just my dream. The problem is that kind of assistance takes a long trajectory to develop and to see results. And in fact, you know, the people who work at Millennium Challenge Corporation have to work with these countries to actually develop a plan that will actually work over a long time frame. And so you don't see money doled out right away. You don't see results right away. One of the weird things that happened with Millennium Challenge was that they weren't giving out money fast enough because they weren't finding – they weren't able to create sort of these aid programs that would work with these different countries. And they got complaints from Congress about this. I can assure you, this is the first time in history people in Congress have complained agencies not spending enough money. That's actually what happened. And so their money, their budgets have been cut, or they've remained constant. That sort of short-term thinking, expecting results right away, is part of the problem. MCC is a great example of, I think, how you can improve aid delivery and how you can actually involve governments in that process. And I think it's more – MCC is definitely more appropriate for countries that are further along in the development than, say, in Afghanistan or Somalia. But it's a great model, and it's one that should be adopted. And unfortunately, because it doesn't provide those immediate results, people don't like it. People in the aid community love it. I mean, some people do. Some people don't like it. But a lot of people in the aid community think it's a good approach.
Well, you talked about improved governance. Does that mean democracy is the best way for a lot of these countries to go?
Well, you know, that's kind of a hard question to answer because I mean, yes is the short answer. But the notion that you need to have elections, for example, as a way to – I mean, for example, we had elections in Afghanistan, which ensured that Hamid Karzai got to serve 5 more years as president. Would we argue that Afghanistan is an example of democratic governance at its finest? No. And part of the problem, I think the focus should be less on elections and less on on sort of that element of the political process and more on building institutions that support democracies. So rule of law development is a hugely important thing. Creating independent judiciaries. Strengthening civil society to be a check on governments. These are crucial elements of democracy, and I think most people in the aid community understand this, and I think even more people in the federal government understand this, that this is how you develop democracies more effectively. The problem is, in the last administration, the whole debate about democracy was distorted by the Bush administration's approach to democracy promotion. My favorite example of this was you saw this in Gaza in 2005, in which the Bush administration forced or basically pushed for elections in Gaza, assuming that Fatah, their party, would win. They didn't. Hamas won. And instead of recognizing the will of the Palestinian people, the response of the U.S. was to basically reject the results, to cut off assistance, and to support an Israeli-led blockade against Hamas. That I can't think of a better way that you could do to undermine the idea of democracy, even having elections for democracy, than that result. The same thing in Egypt. We went to Egypt in 2005. We pushed the idea of having a less sort of corrupt, less autocratic system in Egypt. And then 2 years later, we basically shifted course. We needed Egypt's help on other issues of interest in the Middle East. So, you know, I think – and then the Obama administration's response to this has been, to sort of view democracy as a four-letter word and to view this as something that's going to undermine U.S. efforts in the Middle East and U.S. efforts around the world. It's really unfortunate, and I think that this administration has yet to figure out how do you promote democracy. How does a progressive president promote foreign policy of a democracy around the world? And I think, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I'm not very impressed with what they've done so far. They've shown a lot of the president went to Cairo, gave a wonderful speech, but didn't really push the Egyptian government at all on democratic accountability. And in fact, cut off money for civil society groups in Egypt. This is a terrible decision. I mean, horrible decision that they did in a way to curry favor with Egyptians so they'll help them on Arab-Israeli peace process. You know, how's that working out? That was not such a great idea. I think on Chinese human rights, the president's trip to China, there wasn't enough pushback on the Chinese government on human rights, which has always been a feature of U.S.-Chinese relations. So I think there's been just a lack of focus in this administration on democracy promotion, and it's unfortunate.
Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where there is only time for only one last question.
I guess, have you seen any examples emerging out of the non-government sector that suggest there's a new focus on long-term development and followed up by programs that really are sustainable, or are we still swirling around waiting for governments?
I think, you know, it's an ad hoc system, and I think there are obviously places. There are plenty of groups that are thinking of this thing in much more, I think, long-term sort of perspectives on this. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think MCC is a great example of how you can create aid programs that are actually have more sustainability to them and actually encourage the kind of results that you want to see from countries that you're giving foreign assistance to or countries that are sort of on a certain development trajectory. So I think there's lots of room for optimism. I think one of the things about this new reality is you've got so many actors that are able to play a role here. And this is the big, this is what I think is so important. The barriers to entry have fallen so precipitously. So many more actors can play a role. And so hopefully, you know, there's a sort of market-driven element here where the cream rises to the top. I think that actually happens in a lot of places, more often than probably maybe I get credit for in my speech, but it does happen quite a bit. And I think that is, I think there's a lot of room for optimism in some respects because you're able to see so many more actors playing a role than they did before. So thank you. Those are great questions. I really appreciate it.
Well, our thanks to Michael Cohen for his very interesting and thought-provoking discussion this evening. We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 106 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.